Bum 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 bum.
La 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 la.
Keep going.
Movies.
Keep going.
La 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 la. Movies. La 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 la. La 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 la.
Bum 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 bum. Linoleum knife.
We forgot to bring the recording.
I'll take the blame.
Yeah, that's on you.
I forgot to bring the music, the theme music for Linoleum Knife. Because I'm not in my home. I'm on location. This is Dave, by the way.
Dave White. Movie critic for Linoleum Knife.
That's, yeah. And I'm in a nearly empty apartment where I've awoken with my leg chained to the wall. And a man has put a tray of food in front of me. He won't tell me where I am or why. That man is William Bibbiani.
And
for my sexy abductor. Yeah,
for the record, this was all consensual. We have a safe word in everything for this situation. This was all Dave's request. Everybody, William Bibbiani here. Film critic for Crave Online, and I write for Coming Soon and Blumhouse, and I do stuff for the Young Turks with Alonzo Duralde, who is not here because...
Mr. Duralde is at South by Southwest being important. He's on a jury there.
He's not just covering South by Southwest. Yeah. He's actually making South by Southwest happen.
He's
keeping Austin weird.
Legitimacy
right now
to South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And he left this morning. And I think we've covered this ground before, but if you can't be with the one you love.
Love Bibbs.
Indeed.
We normally I'm at South by Southwest as well, but this year my outlet said, screw it, you're not going. So I'm not.
I'm never at South by Southwest.
Yeah. You know what? It's hot.
Oh, I know.
And the food's good. I'll say that.
Food I shouldn't say I'm never there. I've been to one South by Southwest.
Okay.
I covered the music angle of it.
South by Southwest is mostly a film festival for like the first 4 or 5 days, and then it's a great music festival for a week.
Yeah. I was there in 2003, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
And
that was a while ago. Who'd you see?
I don't even remember anymore. Ah. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we did this.
It sucked.
Ah.
Being there, I couldn't get into any of the shows I needed to get into.
Okay.
My press credentials were minimal. The magazine I was there for has since folded.
Yeah.
Before they folded, they fired me.
Nice. Oh, good. Yeah. They couldn't even just let it go.
No.
They had to like make sure. Listen, we're folding, but the important thing is that you know we rejected you first.
I'm going to say that in spite of the fact that they fired me, they folded after they fired me.
Exactly.
So,
what jerks?
Actually, they were very jerkish about it.
Right?
When they got rid of me.
Yeah. What did they do?
They told me that I was no longer needed. And I said, would you care to explain?
That sounds like how you fire a butler on Downton Abbey.
Yeah, yeah. No. It was a weird way to go. They said, we're moving in an editorial direction that we don't think you're going to like. And I said, can you explain a little more than what you just explained? And they said, well, you know, we've got a lot of new advertisers that I think aren't going to be happy with the kind of stuff you do.
Mm. As a writer, you are completely incapable of writing different stuff.
Meaning awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a very weird moment. And what I learned in that very weird moment was that it actually had nothing to do with that.
Probably not.
That the publisher of this magazine never liked me.
Yeah.
And the editors that he had in when I started, and then when a second editor came along, those editors were really into me and what I did.
Yeah. So this was a new editor who came
along. And along came
you?
A new editor.
That happens every time.
With whom I had nothing in common.
There was nothing more nerve-wracking.
On any level.
There's nothing more nerve-wracking when you're writing for a publication consistently, not like doing a little freelance work, but that's your gig, than a new editor.
Oh, yeah. I was one of the senior editors of the magazine.
Oh, you were even one of the editors. Yeah. But like a new managing editor.
Yes.
They when you come into any new position in a role of authority and no one knows you, you need to... It's kind of like going to prison. You need to like beat someone up the first day.
Right.
Or no one will take you seriously. So the first thing you do is you send out an email that sounds like a little vaguely like you might lose your job if you don't follow in line, but you try to be super polite about it.
Yeah.
You fire a couple of people, you lower people's budgets, you do stuff like right away so people know you mean business.
Yeah.
And then, of course, no one likes you. And but they don't have to like you because you're the boss. And everyone who's there is like freaking out, panicking. Oh, God, what if they don't, you know, what if they move in a different editorial direction? And then usually it's fine.
This was not fine.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying usually, strike that. Usually it works out for the best.
Yeah.
Did it work out for the best?
For me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, ultimately.
That's
because,
the important thing.
Look, here comes the rain again.
It's starting to rain.
Yeah, no, it did. I
have to move in this weather. That's great.
I quit. I got fired and I called another editor at a different magazine, and I said, "Hey, guess what just happened?" And she said, "What?" I said, "I just got canned from Magazine X," and she said, "Oh, that's great. I own you. So I would now like you to do the next cover for us."
That's basically, okay, that's awesome, but that's basically like, hey, my wife just left me, and you go immediately to that person who's always wanted to have sex with you.
Yeah.
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 And it's just great.
You're right, William Bibbiani.
We are reviewing some movies on this show. We forgot to mention that.
Exactly three.
This is a podcast of the cinema.
This is a... Thank you.
What are we? We are Linoleum Knife, a podcast like 8 minutes into the podcast.
For saying what we are. Yeah. We got three this week. And
kind of slim.
It's very slim this week. There'll be more when Mr. Duraldi gets back. I've got the new A Pitch Up Pong. We're a Seth a Cool film to see while he's gone, which he's already seen.
And so have I. And I'll tell you right now, didn't get a second of it. Didn't understand it at all.
But you've seen his other films.
Actually, I haven't. And I feel really bad about that.
Okay,
and I'm thinking maybe this was a bad one to start with.
Maybe.
Like, you know, like maybe this doesn't unlock Mr. Mountain's films.
I'm gonna tell you something. They're all fairly similar in the way that they do not give up their meaning quickly.
I don't care about quickly. Quickly is fine. I want it someday. And I'm not sure I got it from Cemetery of Splendor. There's a lot of stuff in Cemetery of Splendor. Cemetery of Splendor is an interesting film, and I'll definitely... No denying it. I'm definitely not saying it's a bad movie.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that it is so rigidly... of its culture.
Oh, yes.
That has absolutely no interest in walking anyone through it.
Nope.
Now, I don't need, like, you know, a big dumb Matrix speech about how this... What country is it from again?
Thailand.
Yeah. How Thai mysticism works. I don't want that. I don't need that. But at least at one point, someone could just say, you know, this, it's that thing. That would have been great. And instead, it just sort of does stuff.
No.
I know I sound really inarticulate because the movie didn't tell me what to articulate.
Nothing you're saying surprises me.
Yeah.
I would suggest that you go look at Tropical Malady.
Uh-huh.
Or Uncle Boonmee.
Uncle Boonmee, who can remember his past lives, is the film by this filmmaker who I think... more people have heard about.
Yeah.
It's certainly the one that people talk about, even if you don't know the filmmaker's name or how to pronounce it, like me.
It's got, perhaps, it's got the showiest weird stuff in it.
It makes for a good trailer. I remember seeing the trailer for this film, Uncle Boonmay, and saying to myself, well, that looks neat. I'll see that someday. And I just never got around to it. It's, you know, I know every, there's someone out there who every time a film critic says they haven't seen a movie, especially like a big movie in some regards, their immediate thought is, well, their opinion is worthless.
Right.
They don't deserve that job.
Right.
Without thinking to themselves, there's probably at least one film. Like, I'll put it to you. Like, you know, like, oh, you're mad that I haven't seen, I don't know, what the hell. You know, I've never seen The Deer Hunter.
Right.
I feel bad about that. I'll get to it eventually. And someone out there saying, you haven't seen The Deer Hunter. I'm like, okay, great. You seen Tokyo Story?
And they're like, what's that?
Exactly. Or, and maybe they have seen Tokyo Story. They, and that's absolutely fantastic. Great. Then they win. Then they immediately get my job. They just immediately, like, the power, like, transfers.
You hand it over to the, you trade, actually, it's jobs like, with them.
It's like the demon from Fallen. They just sort of come into my body and you get me.
You go to the office where they work.
Yeah.
With, like, the numbers on the computer thing that they do all day.
Oh, yeah. And I just sort of stare at it. And you look at it. No one notices that I've...
Type. Numbers.
Is my Minesweeper all day. Yeah. Like, that's all. Yeah.
And then you're like, here, I'm done. Here are all the numbers.
Basically, yes. That's
give money, please. And then they get to go be a film critic.
In any case, so that's why you'll be reviewing Cemetery Splendor next week
with
Alonzo, because I know, because we reviewed that briefly on the Sundance episode of Linoleum Knife, and we did a bit of a crossover. But the important thing is that you need to see it, and we need to hear your opinions. Where would you like to start on the movies we are reviewing?
I want to do Cloverfield Lane first.
Okay.
And then maybe after we're done,
talk about spoilers?
Talk a little spoilery stuff so that people who don't want to know anything can wait till the very, very, very,
that's
very
fair.
End. And we'll warn you.
That's fair. I like that.
And then we'll talk.
All right. 10 Cloverfield Lane, for those who don't know, I don't know how, is the latest film from J.J. Abrams' production company, Bad Robot.
Yes.
And like many films from J.J. Abrams' production company, Bad Robot, it has been shrouded in secrecy.
That's right.
That's their marketing gimmick. It's, we've got a new movie. Benedict Cumberbatch is playing an important villain in the Star Trek universe. Is he con? We're not going to tell you, and that's going to freak you out for forever. And then you'll be disappointed when you find out that, yes, he was con. Like, that's kind of their shtick. They call it the puzzle box. It's more interesting to wonder about what's in the puzzle box than to actually see what's in the puzzle box, which is a great marketing gimmick and a bad way to tell a story, because eventually we have to unlock that box.
Okay.
And I find a lot of their films end up being a little bit more hollow. And if they just told me that Super 8 is just an E.T. knockoff, I would have appreciated it as a pretty good E.T. knockoff.
I really love Super 8.
Super 8's fine, but they sold it like it might be something more and more interesting. And it's not. It's just an E.T. knockoff.
Yes.
And a good one.
Yeah.
It would have been a lot more satisfying if they just come out and told us that if what was on the box was inside the box, we wouldn't be mad that what was in the box was just like a bunch of dead beetles or something. It was just like, oh man, I was hoping it was cookies. Turns out it's dead beetles. So 10 Cloverfield Lane is the latest mystery from them. The first trailer was only 2 months ago.
Yes.
Before this, it was called something else. I think it was called Valencia.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Hmm.
It definitely had a different title. I think it was Valencia. And the plot is, the setup that we got in all the trailers is Mary Elizabeth Winstead is a young woman. She's in a car accident and she wakes up in an underground bunker with John Goodman and John Gallagher Jr. from Newsroom.
Yes.
And they tell her that...
That's where I've seen that cat from, yes.
He has a poofy beard and he's got like his arm in a sling the whole time.
Right.
They're kind of hiding it, but that's totally him. And they basically say, hey, listen... It's the end of the world out there.
Yeah.
And you can't leave because the air is now toxic.
Yes.
I know that's hard to believe, but we can't let you leave because if we're right, we all die.
Yeah.
Which raises the question, is anything actually going on out there? Because we have to take their word for it.
Right.
That's a cool setup for an Outer Limits episode.
And I think that's as much as we should say.
More or less, yeah.
Plot.
Yeah, for now. Again, spoilers later, because eventually the movie does have to... I'm not going to tell you what it reveals. It will reveal some of its secrets to you. Because otherwise it'll be a real cheap.
It reveals one of them.
Yeah,
within the first 2 minutes. And it's a visual clue.
Oh, yeah.
As to where you are.
mm-hmm.
and as to where the story is located.
Yeah.
And but otherwise, anything after that little visual clue mm-hmm. is thoroughly mysterious until the final moments.
But
really.
In any case.
Yeah.
And we're not going to tell you how much they reveal until yeah. later on. But suffice it to say, I will say that the first 90% of this movie, great potboiler.
Mm-hmm.
Just really fun, yeah. very well crafted, very well acted. And honestly, I liked the story that it told beyond just the plot.
Yeah.
Because what we've got here is a story of a woman who, at the beginning of the film, she's running away from a husband. And she's taking with her like a notebook of forgotten dreams. She wanted to be a clothing designer.
Yeah.
And she's taking that with her and not much else. So that she can be free. She can be free of a marriage that was, we don't get too many details, but apparently it wasn't happy.
No.
And then she is immediately sent into a bunker with a very patriarchal gentleman who wants to treat her like his daughter.
Yes.
And who has made his bunker like a 1950s suburban house. And she can't
like
leave
this weird,
now.
Ugly country kind of stuff that mm-hmm. you would get if you bought all your furniture at, you know, Sam's Club.
Sam's Club with like two antique tables or
yeah.
something. Like a couple of things you got at a yard sale.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, so she's stuck here, and now for her own safety, she isn't allowed to go out into the world, and she has to be subservient to this guy who may or may not have her best interests at heart.
Right.
And then at some point she has to develop as a character and grow and find her own individuality again. That's a great basis for a story.
Yeah.
And with a great basis for a suspenseful thriller. It's a great movie until the end, which we'll talk about later.
Now, so what you're telling me
yeah.
is that you do not approve of the resolution.
Here's what I will say. I wrote a big article about this, published this morning.
Okay.
By the time we're recording this, it's on Crave Online. You can read it if you want.
Okay.
It's called Why the Ending of 10 Cloverfield Lane Sucks.
Who wrote that?
Me.
Oh, okay, great.
I wrote that.
Yeah,
I waited on my review until people had had an opportunity to see it, because this is one of those movies. There's a frustrating thing with the whole spoiler culture.
Yes.
There's a difference between telling people something that happens in a movie and spoiling the movie.
Correct.
Like, telling someone that Rey is the protagonist of Star Wars The Force Awakens wasn't a spoiler. The movie isn't ruined for you.
Correct.
If you know that, because the movie tells you that in the first, like, 10 minutes.
Right.
That's not a spoiler. Telling someone the ending is a spoiler. I think we can all agree on that.
Yes.
So, I didn't want to spoil it for anyone, but the issue is, when the problem with a movie is intrinsically related to something that is considered a spoiler, it's very difficult to critique it in advance and give people the information that they need
right.
to know whether or not they want to see it.
Yeah.
Case in point, Star Trek Into Darkness, which is all based around the mystery of who Benedict Cumberbatch was. And everyone thought, oh, is he Khan? And it turns out he was Khan.
Right.
The movie is based on a mystery that was obvious from the trailer. It's like M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. But we're not allowed to talk about it. We're not allowed.
The Village completely took me by surprise.
Really?
Yes.
I guessed it from the trailer. I looked at The Village and I'm like, oh, they're just not in the... Oh, I
don't watch enough trailers.
Oh, there you go.
I really try to avoid them.
Yeah.
With the exception of my new current favorite trailer film, The Miracles from Heaven... trailer film, which
follows
is
us everywhere we go.
The entire film in the trailer, where they tell you every single thing that happens.
Robert Zemeckis keeps more at bay than Miracles from Heaven.
In the trailer.
I think
I've seen
the
trailer
shot.
For Miracles from Heaven about 11 or 12 times, accidentally, because I'm at other movies, and boy, they are selling this one all over the place. I finally get to see the expanded trailer on Monday night.
Oh, no.
Coming soon, Monday night. Where they will fill in all the gaps between the points, the plot points that they completely give away in the trailer.
Oh, so you're actually seeing the movie?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't even been invited to that. Can I be your plus one?
If I get a plus one, I'll
please
I'll
let
take
me know.
Yeah, yeah.
I go. I think I'm free. But in any case, the
for me, you're free.
It's a problem for a critic. It's a problem for a critic to, because a critic is responsible not just for telling you what they thought. You can do that in a YouTube comment or a tweet.
Yes.
A critic is responsible for explaining why they reacted a certain way.
Yes.
They need to have an understanding of the art form, the history of the art form, the people involved, and basically how storytelling works in order to explain, I had a problem because of this.
Right.
And when the problem is something that the marketing for the film tells you can't talk about because it would be impolite, I feel like I'm being yanked around.
we're being strangled by the marketing. And I don't like that. I disapprove of that. But in all fairness, this is literally the ending this time. So I held off my review. We'll talk about it at the end of this podcast, specifically why I think the secret that is revealed, the one that you're thinking of anyway,
yes,
I think that is not in and of itself a problem. I think the problem is how it is handled.
Mm. Okay.
And we will talk about that at the end of the podcast. So if you want to skip ahead, you more or less can. Or if you want to see the movie first and then listen to it, we'll get to it eventually.
Yeah.
Any more thoughts on 10 Cloverfield
Lane? Yeah, I loved John Goodman's performance.
He's so good in everything, though, isn't he?
I think he's so great. And often, lately, the way we get him, mm-hmm, in this post-Roseanne world we live in, mm-hmm, we get a little, supporting character John Goodman every once in a while.
That's the majority of his cinematic output.
The Coens love him, thankfully, and they use him,
Well, they do interesting things with him, too.
Yes.
Because sometimes he'll show up in something like Flight.
Yeah.
And he'll be okay.
Pointlessly.
But he's fine. Anyone could have done
anyone,
that role.
Yeah,
anyone could have done that role. But when the Coens use him, it's so much better for having John Goodman do it.
Right.
They play off of his Roseanne persona, and they give him something else. Maybe it's something sad. Maybe it's something threatening.
Yeah.
Maybe it's both, like in The Big Lebowski, but it's great.
Yeah.
They know what to do with John Goodman.
So here, he is given so much room to be awesome, and and he uses all of it, which I was really happy about. I could not help myself from thinking that if this movie had been written and directed by a woman, a lot of the film would have played out differently.
Well, because again, it is a female empowerment story. It is.
Ish.
That's kind of the fundamental narrative underneath it all.
It should be more of one, maybe.
Okay.
But your statement is sticking in me, because the word empowerment drives me crazy.
Fair enough.
I believe that women's stories can be told by men, but are infrequently told by men in a way that women would tell them. And so,
totally fair.
Unless you're a filmmaker like Todd Haynes, who has a particular sensitivity, who takes women's lives and examines them, I won't say in a detached way, but in a way that is removed enough that his own expectations for women are not often in play.
I am reminded of, this isn't about women, this is about different cultures, different races, if you will.
Right.
Cry Freedom.
Yeah.
In which it's the story of a South African revolutionary played fantastically by Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
But the protagonist has to be Kevin Kline as the white guy who realizes...
Yes.
You know, it becomes this guilt movie, and it's not actually about the person it's about.
Right.
And that's frustrating and kind of pointless, really, if you think about it. It's basically, Stonewall tried to do the same thing. Let's make the protagonist as non-threatening to the Caucasian white people who won't be seeing the movie anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
same deal.
Having said those two things, I agree with you. It was a really exciting suspense film. And then you find out the secret.
Uh-huh.
And after you find out the secret, after I found out the secret, for the rest of the film, whatever it was, 10, 12 minutes.
About 10 minutes.
I sat in my seat going...
Right? It's kind of laughable, isn't it?
Well, not in a derisive way.
Yeah.
I wasn't laughing at it. I felt pulled along on a whole new ride that then just stopped.
Right.
And so perhaps it should have been a longer film or something. I'm not sure just yet. I literally walked out of this movie 75 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
I just came from the screening to your brand new, super exciting, two-bedroom apartment.
Yes.
That you have now with...
That I'm moving into with my fiance.
The Lady Michelle. Yeah.
Yes. It's very exciting.
It is.
It's a nice place, right?
It's a nice place.
Yeah. It's got a fireplace in this sucker.
I'm noticing. Yeah. And you also have a lavender wall.
That was not our choice, and we're going to pay over that as soon as we can. We were going to have the whole place painted, and then we found out how much that actually costs, and we were just like, we'll just get that one wall.
We'll just get that one wall done.
Because everything else is white, standard, not amazing, but what are you going to do? And there's just one lavender wall.
Yeah.
Why?
That's called an accent wall.
It is called an accent wall. But the accent is annoying. This is Johnny Depp's accent in Tusk.
Perpetual Easter. It looks like a giant peep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Purple peep.
Anyway.
So you were entertained.
Regardless. I was actually really entertained. And I feel as though if there's going to be another movie in the future with the word Cloverfield in the title.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. As opposed to, say, for example, you and I were at
the Brothers Grimsby.
You and I were at Young Messiah last night, and they showed the trailer for Ice Age the Ninth, or whatever.
Age Collision Course.
However many,
which is
there
all
are
about
now.
How a meteor struck the Ice Age and killed all the mammals. And I'm like, I think I appreciate that these movies have a tenuous grasp on history.
Yes,
that's a big suspension of disbelief right there. That's kind of a lot, isn't it?
I don't even care about that.
I care about
what
that.
I care
We're
about.
Teaching our kids about this.
What
stuff.
I care about is my own selfish happiness, which is this. Because I no longer work for movies.com, I don't have to see any more Ice Age movies. And so each new fresh Ice Age movie that comes along and ends a certain way with the promise of yet another Ice Age movie coming down the pike.
Yeah.
In my old job, I would sit in that Ice Age movie and think, I want to die. Please, please, someone cut my throat so that I don't have to see any more Ice Age movies. So I never will now. I will never see another one again unless someone offers me a princely sum.
What is a princely sum?
To review.
How much would I have to give you to have you to review an Ice Age movie? Because we're gonna kickstart this.
No, we're not. But anyway, the ending of this film, of 10 Cloverfield Lane, made me think to myself, all right,
yeah,
I'll go to the next one then.
We'll talk about the ending specifically because while I wouldn't mind seeing another film with Cloverfield in the title,
yeah,
I would mind if the reason why Cloverfield was in the title felt shoehorned into somewhere it didn't belong.
Yeah.
That would bother me.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about that later. Let's move on. What do you want to talk about next?
Young Messiah.
Okay, Young Messiah. This is a movie I wouldn't have seen if I wasn't doing this podcast. Not because I have necessarily anything against it, but because I'm very busy. And it's not really in the sort of under the Crave umbrella of the stuff we usually cover.
Do we know how widely this is opening?
It's pretty wide, actually. Right? This is like one of like the three wide releases, or the four wide releases this weekend. Yeah, it's a big one.
We wandered. Well, I bought a ticket.
I was given one.
You were going to buy a ticket. And then you got to the mall earlier than I did.
Yeah.
And the church that bought out one of the houses
gave me a ticket.
Gave you a free ticket.
I was walking into the food court, ready to gorge myself on the many delightful comestibles contained therein.
Yes.
And this woman comes up to me and says, excuse me, would you like to see a movie tonight? Normally when someone asks you that question, particularly in Los Angeles, they're asking you to see like an advanced screening of something.
Right, right.
And normally I say no because I'm industry now and then not what they're looking for. And this time it was like, no, we had a whole group to see Young Messiah at 7 when you and I were going. And we have an extra ticket. And my first thought was, oh, they can't even give the tickets away.
No.
And my second thought was, oh, hey, well, I'll just take that. Free ticket. Thanks, Jesus. And my third thought was, oh, was I just proselytized?
Yep.
This is why I'm a Christian today. Was it yesterday? Was the nice giving hearts of the people who gave me a ticket to see the Young Messiah. A film about the young adventures of Jesus, much like the young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Right.
Based on a novel by Anne Rice. After her kinky vampire days.
Yes.
And, you know, you are obsessed with Christian cinema.
I am.
And there's with good cause, because Christian cinema, particularly lately, it seems, but probably always.
It's getting wilder and wilder.
It's getting weird. It's getting, like, more conventionally popular. Like, it's doing better at the box office than ever before, en masse, anyway.
Depending on...
Yeah. Every year, there's a one or two big ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
That make a lot of money.
Yes.
And they're usually very low budget, and they're usually very naively told.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, they're outright laughable for one reason or another.
Oh, yeah.
It's sad because there's nothing inherently wrong with telling a Christian story and even making a story that's like, hey, Christianity is neat, because there's a lot of great stories about why other stuff is neat.
Christianity, neat.
That would be awesome. There's
Jesus, man.
Right? Hey, Scotty. Jesus, man. Look up, hey, Scotty. Jesus, man.
Yeah.
Watch the 10-second clip on YouTube. You will thank me.
Yeah.
In any case, there's no reason why Christian cinema has to be bad. None whatsoever. There's great stuff in the Bible. Interesting stuff.
I fully agree with you. And I believe that one of the reasons I, based on my own childhood background.
Yeah.
I have always felt competent to review these films in a way that that isn't, you know, some secular outsider coming along to you know, take a big dump on the Christian movie.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why I don't cover a lot of them, is because it's not my bag, and I honestly can't tell you what's good scripture, what's bad scripture,
etc. I grew up in this. I know it backwards and forwards.
Mm-hmm. I was raised by lapsed Catholics, which basically made me an agnostic until I grew up and became an atheist.
Yes.
I went through like a brief period when I was in like the sixth grade, and I found about the concept of touching yourself in an impure manner, and I was worried about going to hell, so I became like super religious for about 3 months.
Right.
And then I stopped.
Right.
And then... And that's fine. I got nothing against.
And now you're a daily toucher.
I am a daily toucher. No, I got nothing against religion in. Wow, it is coming down.
Yeah.
That's like a torrential downpour now. That's insane. Yep. And this is God telling us, giving us a sign about the young Messiah. In any case, look, I got nothing against it. I don't agree with a lot of it. There's a reason why I'm not a religious person. But there's religious movies that are perfectly good. And I gotta tell you, having seen a fair number of the recent crop of Christian cinema, not as much as you, but a fair amount.
Yeah.
This is not one of the worst ones.
No, it is not.
This is actually like, it's kind of cheap, but for a Christian movie, it's actually kind of expensive.
Yes.
It's actually got some good performances in it.
Yeah.
There's nothing in it that's like, there's some really oversold moments, but there's really nothing in it that's embarrassing. This is actually kind of okay. I wasn't expecting something bad. This is actually pretty good.
It is kind of okay. If we divorce it from the fact that it is based on an Anne Rice novel, and I'll talk about her a little bit in a minute, then what you have is a really run-of-the-mill, sober, reverent fantasy of...
some of the years of Jesus' life that aren't in the Bible.
The years of Jesus' life as a child, which are not in the Bible. There
just
is
skimmed
one,
over.
One reference in the book of Luke that says that he would go to the temple and ask questions, and then he grew in wisdom and stature. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all you get. Mm. So... when Anne Rice, in the late 90s, sort of reaffirmed her Christian faith after being an atheist and agnostic.
And telling many a kinky vampire story.
For many a year, yeah. She became a Christian again. She has now moved...
threw that into another phase of her life where her relationship with the church and with the word Christianity is very complicated. She herself is still a person of faith. But during that time, during the time when she was actively re-involved in the Catholic Church, she wrote
a number of Christian
stories. She wrote two that I know of.
Okay.
The one that this movie is based on is called Christ the Lord, Out of Egypt. Speculating...
Curse of the Black Pearl.
Yeah. Speculating that as a boy, unlike as it is described in the Bible, as a boy, Jesus came to understand that he had these powers to heal, to raise the dead.
Mm-hmm. That it would probably... He'd probably... figure it out at some point.
Was in the process of questioning why he was different. And of course, there were pursuers.
Mm-hmm. Picking up the stragglers from Bethlehem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, because I haven't read the book, I don't know how much of the book made it through to the final product of this film.
Right.
But... what I do know is that it feels very similar to an origin story of a superhero or like Harry Potter. There is even the villain, the main villain, the actor that everyone knows, Sean Bean, who's in this movie. His character, he's a Roman centurion whose name is Severus.
Much like the Harry Potter character, Albus Dumbledore.
Indeed.
Severus Snape.
Yeah.
I know. I've read the Harry Potter books. I know the Harry Potter books.
So I know. Yeah. So of all the things to rip off, you know, and who knows? Maybe she called this man Severus in the book. I don't know. Oh,
It's a real name. It's a thing. I didn't make it up.
I know.
It's not like he's called Spider-Man.
But come on. And so what I do know is that this film has the feel of a movie that would like to have sequels and maybe develop itself into Young Jesus franchise.
And you know what? There's room.
There is room, and there are worse things you could do.
Because this movie is actually, it's not complicated, but it basically functions.
Yeah.
They're in Egypt. They fled to Egypt to sort of just get away from that whole Herod business.
Yeah.
Herod
wants the one kid who survived the slaughter of the infants
is, of course, Jesus. Like the one we miss. We might as well not have bothered.
Well, that, the original slaughter of the infants was meant to kill Jesus.
Yes, it was.
Perhaps you are aware of that. And you know, he's Jesus. Of course, he got away, and so.
Just Romans throwing their helmets to the ground, going, "Oh, Jesus!"
they chase him. They chase the family, Mary, Joseph,
and Jesus's wacky uncle.
Wacky uncle, played by Christian McKay, who's like the comic relief of the movie.
And
like, there should be like the womp womp boom kind of music that to accompany him. There isn't. But
here's the weird thing is though, is even though as broadly constructed as this character is, you like him.
Oh, yeah, you're into him.
Mostly because he's Christian McKay and he's really selling it. But, like, yeah, he's just this guy who happens to be kind of outspoken and funny. He doesn't feel like he's interjecting. It's not like he's jumping into the movie to keep the kids from getting bored. He's just playing a guy who happens to be kind of a funny guy.
Right.
That's fine.
Yeah, there were funny people back then, obviously.
So they're going on a journey. They're going back to Nazareth.
They don't know where they're going to go. At one point, they say, we'll just stay in caves. And Uncle Joe, or whatever his name is, goes, I hate living in caves.
And they end up running into various misadventures along their way.
Right.
Some of which matter, some of which don't.
Uh-huh.
Some of which are actually pretty well acted. There's like this old lady who I guess is like his grandmother or something.
They don't fully establish who she is.
Regardless, she's great. Actually, there's actually this well-written scene where...
she played the Russian princess on Downton Abbey.
I didn't see that season. Okay, but... yeah, so they run into... this old lady that I guess they know, and then a couple of Roman centurions. It's just like, hey, we're crucifying people today.
Yeah.
You're bandits. And they're like, but we're not actually bandits. Well, just tell us which one of you you want to be a bandit, and we'll only crucify them. And then this old lady comes out, and she just says, I have sweet treats and wine. And they're like, are you trying to bribe us? Yes. Yes, I'm trying to bribe you. Well, this is good wine. I'm not going to try to save my family with crappy wine. Like, take the wine. And they're like, well, I guess this is pretty good wine. Goodbye. I'm sure we won't regret not killing you later. And then they go. It's a series of misadventures. Some of them were quite entertaining. I didn't drag too much. I didn't check my watch a lot during the movie. The idea, Sean Bean's character, is actually kind of a neat character.
It's very similar to the character that Joseph Fiennes plays in Risen.
I missed it, but regardless, yeah. And he's also very similar to the character George Clooney's character is playing in Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar, yes.
Where he's a Roman centurion, he was involved in the whole slaughtering of the newborn children thing, yeah. And he still feels kind of conflicted about that, but yeah. He's still got to do it, and then he's just like, oh, do I have to? Man. And Sean Bean, to his credit, he's an underrated actor, he sells it.
Yeah.
Pretty well, actually. But I mean, it's not great or anything like that. It's not high drama, you know. It's no Last Temptation of Christ or Ben-Hur or anything. But,
and I believe that's the doing of the filmmakers. I'm going to blank on his name because it's difficult to remember his name.
It's hard to pronounce.
You looking it up?
Oh, yeah. Hang on. I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up. It's a thingy, and his name was Stuff. I'm just filling time. The Young Messiah. The Young Messiah was directed by Cyrus Nowrasta.
Yeah.
Nowraste?
Okay. Thank you.
One of those.
Thank you. He is a very literal-minded filmmaker.
It's not a subtle film.
And therefore, you don't get the sort of fantastical elements that you might normally expect from a film that deals in the supernatural. People's entire life directions are premised on are predicated on visions and dreams and you know, just mm-hmm.
God, when God wants to send you a message in this movie, God, he sends it in a dream because email hasn't been invented yet.
Right.
So, and they just say they saw it in a dream, like, but we never see it.
I had a dream, so that's, we're going to do it. And so, that is the kind of, you know, meat and potatoes sort of Bible story that you can expect from people who don't want to run afoul of commonly held ideas about this topic.
Yeah.
You know, if your Noah was a hit at the box office, but it was not a hit with conservative evangelicals who took exception to people adding stuff.
Like rock angels.
To the Old Testament, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when angels fell to earth, they got a bunch of rocks on them and became giant rock monsters.
Right.
You know, like it happened.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is not a particularly exciting movie. I don't think it fulfills its mission to get people excited for, you know,
yeah.
Jesus at 14 or however old he's going to be in the next movie. He's
touching yourself in an impure manner. Jesus, yeah.
7 years old in this film. But I can't say that it's horrible. It's simply fine. It's fine.
Totally
the target audience for this will enjoy themselves. If they are adults, kids are going to be bored.
Probably,
because
yeah.
There's filmmaking, it's very sober, it's very sedate. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, an action film at all. They just are walking, and there are occasional fight scenes, but they're badly done.
But really occasional, and frankly very brief.
Yeah.
Because they're also not trying to... I appreciate this much, because it is a Christian movie, and because, you know, how violence is kind of bad, and like Christians probably shouldn't be for that. They're not making it look cool.
Right.
They're just making it look, just, it happened, right. It sucked, and then we moved on with the nicer parts of the story, which is why we're here.
There is a blonde Satan that follows them around.
I was waiting for you to bring up blonde. Because the first thing that happens in this movie is this Jesus, he's seven, he's in Egypt, he's playing with this little girl who was she white and had a bunch of spray on tan?
I don't know.
I don't want to go and make the leap and say that's what was going on. But
there are actors in this movie who are essentially white people with
spray on tan.
Spray on tan.
Lots of bronzer.
Yeah.
She looks like she looks unwell. But regardless, they're playing. Then there's this kid who's really, really mean. And then Satan throws an apple on the ground, and the kid trips on the apple and breaks his neck and dies.
Right.
And then Jesus gets blamed for it because he had the audacity to be 20 feet away.
Yeah.
And which, fine, whatever. People are jerks. But Satan in this movie, he looks completely out of place, which I appreciate. They're literally going for that.
Yes.
But it's a little comical. I'll say this, though.
It's a lot comical.
The guy playing Satan,
yeah,
he's going for it.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
He's not, and I don't mean going for it like Jack Nicholson and Batman. Like, he's just, he's trying to make it work.
Yeah.
He knows he's wearing a stupid-ass costume, but he's working at it.
Yeah.
And he actually has a few competent bits. I was disappointed. There's a part where Jesus gets very sick, and Satan comes to him in a feverish dream and shows him, like, the destruction of Krypton or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Jesus is just like, well, that's bad. And Satan's like, I know, right? You should not be Jesus. And Jesus is like, well. But then Satan's kind of gone. Like, he pops up, like, right at the end to, like, make it. But, and I appreciate that this movie doesn't end with Jesus fighting Satan to death.
No, if you want that, then you see Megiddo, the Omega Code 2.
Oh, yeah. I never saw that one.
It's something.
There is a movie coming out later this year. It premiered at Sundance last year.
Yes.
And it has a very similar premise to this, but it's much better done.
Yeah.
Called Last Days in the Desert.
I have seen it.
You have seen it?
Yeah.
Wasn't it great?
It's not bad.
I liked it a lot, actually.
Yeah,
if you're going to tell an untold story of Jesus, I thought that was a good way to do it.
It's. I'll tell you something. If conservative evangelicals thought that Noah was offensive,
they're gonna be really offended about Last Days in the Desert.
They won't like Last Days in the Desert at all.
Why is that? Well, every single time
you've got
there's a Jesus
one
movie,
one person playing Jesus and the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every time there's a Jesus movie that I watch and that makes me go, wow, you know what? Jesus was a really cool guy. Jesus said and did a lot of things that I totally support, and I kind of want to find out more and maybe consider him in higher regard. Every Christian is against it.
You have just watched a heretical motion picture.
Probably.
Yeah.
Happens every time.
Yeah.
Happens every time. Regardless, I like that one.
You ever seen Godard's Hail Mary?
No.
Same deal.
Okay. That's why it was The Last Temptation of Christ. When I saw Willem Dafoe beating the junk out of some moneylenders, I was like, Jesus is awesome.
He's beating up those guys.
And with good cause. Like, this is great. Like, he's humanized. I see, like, there's something tangible here and not just some figurehead. And then every Christian was just like, well, that's not Jesus. Well, like, well, then I have lost all interest in your religion.
We're going to burn down this theater.
Yeah, I've lost all interest in your religion. In any case, Young Messiah, not as bad as you would think.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a solid meh.
Yeah. For a Christian movie, that's great.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Brothers Grimsby, which is terrible.
Rory Keenan, who plays blonde Satan in Young Messiah, also is in The Brothers Grimsby.
Good for him.
What a weekend he's having.
What a weekend indeed. Brothers Grimsby is
this
a new...
Is, yes.
No, you can go ahead.
Sacha Baron Cohen is a lad.
And sure
lives,
is.
He lives in Grimsby.
And how?
And he's got Noel Gallagher's hair.
He does.
And they don't let you just notice that. They actually have to, like, explain it to you before the movie's over. Like every other joke that gets explained in this film. He is... what in the United States people would refer to disparagingly, perhaps, as white trash.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a girlfriend, Rebel Wilson.
Yes.
They together
It is consistently considered amusing that he would find a woman of her body type attractive.
That is
a recurring joke.
Yeah.
That he doesn't find really attractive, like genuinely attractive women attractive, and he finds... women who the audience is supposed to assume are ugly.
Yes.
Attractive.
Yes.
Which is basically this movie in a nutshell, like what it thinks your sense of humor is.
Yeah.
And if that is your sense of humor, you'll probably laugh at it. And if it's not, you'll be like, oh, God, how long is this? And to its credit, it's only about 83
minutes. It's about 80 minutes, yeah. He's searching for his long-lost brother. His long-lost brother turns out to be Mark Strong, who is an MI6 secret agent. And they go on a spy adventure together.
Basically, that's it. Oh, and they shove a lot of things up their butts.
They do shove a lot of things up their butts. It is Ride Along. If Ride Along were an Adam Sandler film.
Yeah, I was about to say, this movie makes Ride Along look pretty good, doesn't it?
It is the combination of those two things. But I kept thinking about Sandler throughout this film.
Yeah.
Because this is the kind of, like, bottom of the barrel sort of stuff that mm-hmm. you would expect from Sandler.
This is the kind of movie... I owe my parents an apology.
Yeah.
Because I was... I don't remember how old I was when Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls came out. Maybe 12, something like that.
How many times did you see it?
In the theater, only once. Okay. That's all I could convince my parents to go see. My parents, bless them, took me to see Ace Ventura, When... Now, the first Ace Ventura... Dumb, still kind of funny.
Yeah.
There's good stuff in that.
Yeah.
Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls is just nonstop mugging
yeah.
and insults
yeah.
and grossness and horror.
Yes.
And I thought it was great when I was 12.
Well, yeah.
Because I was immature.
Yes.
And that's fine. It's okay to be immature. Everyone's going to be immature for a while. I'm not even saying that it's better to be mature, but that's what I am now. And watching something like, and I'm not even saying I'm mature, I'm more mature than I was when I was 12. Just to be clear.
I've moved on past 12.
Yes. And thank goodness. Brothers Grimsby is that level of just constant bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
Like 5-year-old birthday party clown mugging. And it is boring as a result because it's the same jokes over and over and over again. Occasionally, there's one that'll make you laugh because there are talent. Sacha Baron Cohen is not an untalented comedian.
Correct.
Mark Strong is a great straight man.
Yeah.
Like, if this movie works at all in any way, it's because Mark Strong is playing ridiculously well
yeah.
off of Sacha Baron Cohen and yeah. having to do stuff that is hopefully not going to go in his lifetime achievement reel.
Right.
And he's committed to it, no matter how terrible the movie is, no matter what they're doing inside of an elephant. And when an elephant is doing...
That's where I was going. I was about to just...
He is selling it like a professional actor, and Sacha Baron Cohen is selling it like he's trying to sell you, like, chocolate syrup in a commercial.
Yeah.
Like, he's the Nesquik bunny.
Yeah.
But he's getting sexually assaulted by an elephant.
By a lot of elephants.
By a whole... And it bothers me. Can we say the B-U-K word on here? Is that okay?
Bukkake.
Okay, so I want to make sure that was okay. I didn't want to... I know you're a safe for work podcast.
We're a clean podcast, but you know what?
That's what it's called.
Let's say you're in the car right now with your 4-year-old. That kid doesn't know what that word means.
In any case, he refers to, oh no, it's going to be an elephant bukkake. And then I'm like, you're thinking of a train.
Yeah.
That's not... you don't know what that word means. And something tells me that you, sir, your character in this film, would know very well the difference.
Yes.
So I was offended.
Here's where I'm going to betray any ideas that the listening audience might have about my sophistication level.
You were laughing.
That elephant stuff
made you
was
laugh.
Cracking me up. Yeah.
I was looking at you and going, oh, really, Dave? Look, we all have stuff that makes us laugh that's dumb.
Yeah.
That's fine. It's a dumb movie. We're going to a dumb... No one's... Yeah. Listen, a lot of people are just like... I reviewed this on What the Flick, and people were like...
We should actually explain what happens. They crawl inside an elephant's vagina.
To hide from bad guys, because there's nowhere else to hide in the African plain. To hide from bad guys,
and then elephants begin having sex.
Yes.
And so these... you can guess all the rest.
Yeah, like a whole line of elephants.
Yeah.
In any case, like, people are like, you know, when a critic doesn't like a dumb comedy,
right?
The response is always, why can't you turn your brain off and just like a dumb comedy?
Right.
Because not all dumb comedies are funny.
Right.
They can't be.
I can turn off my brain. I did it within 5 minutes of this film. I thought, okay, I know what I'm about to see here. I understand what's about to happen.
Sure.
In the context of us all living down here in the gutter for the next 80 minutes,
mm-hmm.
please make me laugh.
Yeah. That's fine.
And
nothing wrong with that.
And it made me laugh about 4 times. One of those times was the elephant sex. Yeah.
I'm struggling to remember specifically a time. I know I laughed. I know I laughed at least four times.
Most of the times were a direct result of unexpected responses to straight-faced questions.
Mm-hmm.
And were all a result of, like, good comic timing on the part of the other people.
Right.
You know.
I've liked Sacha Baron Cohen's other movies. I even thought The Dictator was kind of funny, and a lot of people didn't like that one. And the thing is, a lot of those jokes that he was telling, a lot of the offensive jokes, were coming from a place of maybe not necessarily pointed cultural commentary, but there was an idea behind them. And here the idea is, isn't it funny that he's disgusting?
Yeah.
And often it's not. Sometimes it is, specifically within the context of a particular scene. It's fine. But a lot of times it's just the same joke over and over again. And it bothers me. Another thing that bothers me is that this is an action comedy. It's directed by Louis Leterrier, a filmmaker I quite like.
Yeah.
He did the first two Transporter movies.
First two Transporters, yeah.
He's not officially credited on the first one because of contractual obligations if you look that up, but he is.
Yeah.
Those are fun movies. He did The Incredible Hulk, which I think is an underrated superhero flick. Uh-huh. And the action in this movie stinks.
Yeah.
There's an interesting idea. They try to do this whole big sequence where we're seeing it from like a first-person perspective of Mark Strong as he's going through this huge fight sequence and shootout and in the middle of a car chase, and it's all one shot. Which might have worked great if it wasn't a fisheye lens and it wasn't nauseating.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It's frustrating. So I don't think it works particularly well as a comedy, mostly because it didn't make me laugh and because I think the sense of humor is just poking you, hoping you get poked. And then it doesn't work because it's not a particularly good action movie either. I would say it's mildly better than Zoolander 2.
Yeah.
But that's saying nothing. It's a terrible film.
Doing stupid smart still needs to be smart.
Yeah.
And it has to operate on both levels.
When I watch a stupid movie, I don't want to actually think I'm smarter than the people that made it.
Right.
I want them to, you know, like, hey, we made this movie. We know it's silly. We're going to have a lot. Like the Marx Brothers. Those are dumb jokes.
Yeah.
Those are some real dumb jokes in Marx Brothers. Like, we're going to have a standing army. Why? We'll save money on chairs. That's a dumb joke. Smart people told that joke. I don't get that sense. I get that sense from other Sacha Baron Cohen movies. I don't get it from here. This just feels like pandering, and I'm not offended because I can't handle seeing a man's genitalia in a movie.
Right.
I'm offended because the movie thinks that's the only thing that could make me laugh.
Yeah.
That's offensive because I feel like the movie has no respect for me.
Right.
Even my appreciation for dumb humor, the movie has no respect for me. So I didn't take
that was
to it.
The other part that made me laugh.
Was that?
Yeah.
Oh, funny for... Okay, you know what?
Yeah.
Funny for about a minute.
Yeah.
And then it stopped being funny because they really committed to it.
They kept going.
They really committed to it. We're not going to ruin that. That one's gross.
Real
gross.
It's a bad movie.
It's a bad movie.
It's a very bad movie.
I'm not with it.
So,
All right. What do you got for... what's your DVD recommendation for the week?
I don't have one.
You don't have one?
I not only did I forget to bring the music, I forgot to bring my brains about DVDs that are available. And you don't have any Wi-Fi.
You can check your phone. I'll tell you what. While you check your phone, or while I bring up a thing so you can check my phone, I will tell you my DVD pick of the week. This is coming out on DVD on March 15th, or Blu-ray. First time on Blu-ray. Bless them. And it is My Boyfriend's Back.
Remind me what that is. Is that zombie movie from
Yes, it is.
1991,
92.
One or two? Yeah.
This is a movie that was directed by the great Bob Balaban, who also directed the incredible cannibal horror movie Parents, which was also great.
That is a great movie.
I interviewed Bob Balaban once, and I just told him, like, incidentally, I loved Parents. And he looked me right in the eye and said, oh, you must be a very strange person. I just thought that was funny.
Everybody that I knew in the 80s who was punk rock loved Parents.
Parents is great.
Yeah.
But in any case, My Boyfriend's Back was like the next movie he directed, I think.
Right.
And it is also a very silly comedy with a horror bent. But this time the comedy outweighs the horror. The horror is not meant to be taken seriously.
Right.
It is about a guy who has a crush on the cutest girl in school. No one, he has no shot with her. But then he takes a bullet for her in a liquor store robbery. And as he's dying, his dying words are, will you go to prom with me? And what's she going to say? No. So she says yes. And then he refuses to die because he's got a date to prom now.
Right.
Problem is, he's a zombie.
Right.
And there's this great running gag of everyone thinking they need to be, like, racist towards zombies because they're new and different, and why wouldn't they be?
Right.
So, like, Matthew McConaughey and Philip Seymour Hoffman in two of their earliest roles
are
both, like, anti-zombie racists who are just delightful idiots. And his parents... I love his parents in this movie, too, because his parents in the movie, they're so supportive. They love their son. They're going to completely stay... It's if you want to look at it as an allegory for, like, being gay or whatever, it's kind of great because the parents are just like, oh, you're a zombie now. You have to eat human flesh. Well, we kidnapped this child from down the street because you have to eat. And he's like, no! I don't want to. But he can't... He'll die if he doesn't eat human flesh. And so it becomes, like, this whole thing. Can he sacrifice his soul to stay alive long enough to do the thing that makes him happy? Here is a list of the...
The road chip.
Yeah, you might want to scroll a bit. In any case...
Victor Frankenstein.
My Boyfriend's Back is a very silly film, but I have a lot of fun with it, and it was hard to find for a while, and I recommend checking it out because it makes me laugh. It's stupid, but it's made in a smart way, and it makes me laugh.
Brooklyn and Carol are coming out this week?
Well, there you go. Those are good movies. There you go.
Brooklyn and Carol.
Those are good movies.
Both of them.
Good.
Watch them both.
Don't even need to talk about them.
Carol is...
The hell with it.
Carol is magnificent. A work of art.
Yeah.
Brooklyn will make you cry and cry and cry.
Brooklyn is a very sweet... Brooklyn is a... Here's the deal. Carol is a great... When award season ends...
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies that were all you could talk about for a few months that will never be talked about again.
Yes.
That will never be... Even if they're good, they'll never be talked about again unless they won, like, a bunch of awards.
Yes.
That's it. Carol is one that will continue to be talked about.
Yes.
That it's just a damn good movie. It wasn't even my favorite movie of the year or anything like that, but it's a very well-made film, deserves to be talked about. Brooklyn is a film that I suspect will die down. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of people who are super passionate about it and incorporate it into their lives and quote it. But if you see Brooklyn, you will like it.
Yeah.
It is a sweet film, very emotional, and Saoirse Ronan... gives a fantastic performance.
It is a fantastic performance. Yeah. And I know someone... Here's what I think the legacy of Brooklyn is going to be.
Yeah.
People are going to find it. If they didn't see it in this theatrical run, and not many people did, they will find it on cable.
Mm-hmm.
And they will love it. One of my very good friends this past week... saw it with his mother.
Aww.
Yeah. And by the end of it, they were both crying and having a heart-to-heart conversation about life and everything. And I think that's... Brooklyn will be a film that people feel very affectionate toward.
I hope so, because seriously, there's so many great movies that do the whole Oscar run or whatever that when you watch them, you'll say they're great, and you have a nice conversation about them, but for whatever reason, they don't linger. Yeah. Even something like Tom and Viv, or Wings of the Dove, or The Madness of King George.
Right.
These are all movies that were huge awards contenders, maybe even won a few. No one talked... I defy you. When was the last time someone brought up The Madness of King George in casual conversation?
Not The Madness of King George, but Alonzo and I talk about Wings of the Dove quite a bit.
All right, I'll give you Wings of the Dove. Fine. Wings of the Dove, from the director of Hackers.
Yeah.
Okay. Also a great movie. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Okay. So here's what you need to know. Every week, Alonzo has a list of podcasts created by people we know and like. And I don't have that list in front of me, very much like all the other things I don't have in front of me right now. But you know what they are, so go listen to them.
I'm going to say right now, you should listen to the B-Movies podcast.
You should.
Which I do every single week.
Indeed.
We've had some great guests coming up. We got Max Landis, the writer of...
American Ultra.
Yes.
The movie I love that Alonzo hates.
A very interesting conversationalist, Max Landis. I think you're going to have a fun time listening to that episode. Also, Whitney...
Did you already record this one?
We recorded it. It'll come out early next week.
Did you tell him I say hey?
I didn't, because I didn't
What's
know.
What's your deal, man?
I'm sorry. It's a fun episode, though. And also, Whitney Seibold and I, my co-host of the B-Movies podcast, we're starting a new podcast. It'll be coming up in a couple of weeks. I'm moving, so it got delayed a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But it's called Canceled Too Soon. And it is
podcast of the television.
It is a podcast of the television. But the gimmick of this show is that, unlike, we're not just reviewing new stuff, we're reviewing
television. You don't just sit around watching garbage reality TV like I do.
We are going to be reviewing television series that lasted one season or less.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah.
No more.
Yeah.
Like, so, and we're talking like one episode wonders sometimes. Like Emily's Reasons Why Not. That's on the list.
Oh, wow.
But we are looking for suggestions. If there's a show you really want us to cover, we've had a lot of great suggestions so far. So you can tweet us at BMoviesPodcast. You can email us BMoviesPodcast@gmail.com. Let us know your ideas.
Yeah.
And keep an eye out. I'll bug these guys to announce it on their show once the first episode is officially live.
We will do that.
But also you can listen to the B-Movies podcast, which I think is a pretty fun show as well. And
it is. I enjoy it quite a bit.
And so everyone, and where is, because we're going to talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane in detail in a second.
Yeah.
Tell us where we can find Linoleum Knife on the line.
Well, you know, linoleum-knife.com, where you will find our subscription model that we have just recently set up. That's doing weirdly well.
Great. Good for you guys.
And we're really happy about that. We're on Facebook, Linoleum Knife Podcast on Facebook, Linoleum Cast on Twitter, Linoleum Cast on Instagram as well. And what else do I need to be telling you about? Oh, we just recently recorded an episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife. The movie that we do is Die Hard.
Oh,
that's
good one.
$1.99 is what it costs. You PayPal linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Cool.
And that's everything. Okay, so now there are going to be two goodbyes.
Yes, this goodbye.
This would be the goodbye I'm saying to you right now. Goodbye to all of you who do not want to hear what happens in 10 Cloverfield Lane. If you don't want to know that, then this is your exit.
Yeah.
Turn off the podcast. Turn it off.
But if you have seen 10 Cloverfield Lane, or if you have absolutely no desire to see 10 Cloverfield Lane and you don't care, By all means, listen on.
We're going to keep going. When
Whitney and I, on my podcast, we reviewed Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Yes.
We did the same thing. We reviewed the movie with as few spoilers as possible, just tried to give it just sort of a general overview. And then we reviewed in spoilers, because the movie warrants it, because everyone thinks everything in Star Wars is a spoiler.
Yes.
And so when we said, we're going to talk about spoilers now, Whitney immediately yelled out like the death of a character and who killed them and what their relationship, like yelled it. And my fiance Michelle, who hadn't seen the film yet, was in the next room. And so he had to do some penance. So fortunately, no one is around that I'm aware of who hasn't seen 10 Cloverfield Lane. So we can say it was aliens. Aliens all the whole time.
Yes.
Aliens. Elizabeth Winstead emerges from the underground bunker in a hazmat suit.
Of her own construction.
Of her own construction, thinking that the air is unbreathable. She takes off the hazmat suit when she realizes that there are birds around and they're fine. Says, oh, okay. And the movie basically kind of ends right there, regardless of the fact that there's more incident, because she has fought for her individuality. She has fought for her freedom.
Yes.
From an oppressive patriarch.
Yes.
And she has discovered that it was all worth it. She risked an uncertain future for it, and it paid off.
Right.
And then she looks in the horizon and sees a UFO, and she goes, ah, no. And then the UFO like drops a worm monster.
She actually says, which made me really happy, she goes, oh, come on.
Yeah. Which is funny. And then the UFO zooms towards her and it drops a worm monster, and she hides from the worm monster and she distracts the worm monster, and then she gets in a car and she makes a Molotov cocktail as a UFO pulls her up into the UFO, and she like firebombs the UFO, and the UFO goes boom. And then she drives along the road, and then the radio says, if you're a warrior, go to Houston. So she goes to Houston, and then that's the end of the movie. And I'm like, what the hell just happened?
She fights the big alien ship.
It's not that big. It's big, but it's not like Independence Day big.
They drop her on the ground.
Yeah.
Which honestly would kill an actual person.
Or at least broken something.
Broke your leg or
she's
something.
She's not fine.
But
I was in a fender bender at like 12 miles an hour and I needed knee surgery. She's not fine.
Yeah. She gets in a car. And what actually gets said on the radio is, if you are a survivor, there are people in Houston who have fought back and are taking back the southern seaboard.
Uh-huh. But they don't explain how. But they also say that if you need help, if you're like,
if
whatever.
If you need help.
Which is, listen, and that's fine because it's kind of on the nose.
Yeah.
But it's fine. My issue with the ending isn't that there are aliens. Because honestly, it doesn't really matter what it was.
Right.
Could have been terrorists. Could have been anything.
I'm just assuming it's the same stuff that got everybody in Cloverfield.
I assume that, because in the end of Cloverfield, you
see the visual cue at the very beginning of the movie is that she goes into a convenience store and you see the Slusho logo in the window.
Exactly.
And you're like, okay, we're in the Cloverfield
world. It's the same universe.
Yeah.
Cloverfield, at the end of Cloverfield, which is a big giant monster attacks New York movie, if you look carefully in the last scene, which is like a recorded video from before the monster attack, you can see the monster land in like the harbor from space.
Yeah.
It's an alien. So, fine. Great. Okay, so the aliens have attacked, and this is just one story that took place in the universe, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I am. That's fine, because it's totally arbitrary. What really, really matters is her journey. Problem is, her journey ends, and then the movie says, screw it, we're going Fast and Furious for 10 minutes, and we really want to sell just how awesome this was, and then the whole movie kind of becomes about that ending. It doesn't matter. And a lot of people are like, well, that sounds entertaining. That's fine, but you can be entertaining and still be bad.
Right.
I think if you had taken, like, it'd be like at the end of Spotlight, Mark Ruffalo says, oh, well, I'm glad we got all of those Catholic priests and we exposed this whole corruption. Then he gets in a car and then he turns over and looks at Vin Diesel and they get in like a 10-minute car chase. Like, that would be kind of awesome, but that wouldn't make Spotlight a better movie. That would make Spotlight a worse movie.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what happened here. It's such a jarring shift in tone. It feels so tacked on that I think some people... So I wrote my article, Why the Ending of Cloverfield Sucks. And some people say, well, what you're saying is 90% of the movie is great, so it's a positive review.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no. I see why you're thinking that, but no. What I'm saying is that 90% of the movie is great until the last 10%, which hijacks the movie. And now, every time you see 10... It's the same thing with any mystery movie. Anytime you see it, you know the ending going in.
Yeah.
And if that hurts rewatching the movie, then the movie isn't very good, is it?
Yeah.
Like, Sixth Sense works both ways.
Yeah.
To its credit. If you don't know the ending, Sixth Sense works great.
Yeah.
If you know the ending, The Sixth Sense still operates. It's still a very functional drama.
Yes.
But something like The Village does not, because now it's completely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Something like 10 Cloverfield Lane, it's not ludicrous, but you know that everything going on in the bunker, everything that was the only important thing happening to her character, everything that made her the person strong enough to deal with that ending, is now completely inconsequential compared to a larger scope.
Correct.
And I think that is a bad ending.
I agree, and yet I agree to a much...
It doesn't hurt. It doesn't destroy the movie for you.
Yeah, I agree to a much lesser degree, if that's the proper way to use that word in a sentence. Mostly because I had such a good time leading up to the ending, and then during that crazy wacky final 10 minutes, yes, it is, you know, a complete hard left of a detour. Only really minimized by the fact that what it does do is confirm the film as a legitimate sequel to the first movie,
which I don't even know if we needed to go that far to even do that.
Right. It's a bait and switch, and I'm okay with that. I'm not going to see it again, but it was fun and I had a good time.
I think it took a potentially really great movie, like a maybe not an all time classic. I'm not say it's worthy of a whole lot of Oscars or anything, but just a rock solid beginning to end,
Hitchcockian sort of film. Yeah,
really, really good. I wrote on Twitter. I wanted to talk about it without spoilers. So I just said, 10 Cloverfield Lane is a really good Outer Limits episode that suddenly becomes a really bad Outer Limits episode. And I think that's true. I think. It would be fine if it just like, the ending was a little overblown. The movie can still be great. But I honestly think the ending was so overblown that the great movie that preceded it is now less great.
Yeah.
And I can't support that.
Right.
I have to say that I think that that's bad storytelling.
Right.
And I think it's sufficiently bad storytelling that it has sullied the film. Not so much that it's terrible. There's great stuff. The performances are really, really great. There's good writing in it. But I'm not going to call it the worst movie of the year, I think. Like, not even close. No. Not even. If we announced that now, it wouldn't be in my top 10.
We have seen the Brothers Grimsby.
Yeah.
Remember.
In January and February, so much worse movies. This movie is okay. And if you're entertained by this movie, and if you're entertained by the ending, and what I just said doesn't bother you at all, fine. That's totally fine. I don't have that much passion about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's a good ending. I think it's a bad ending. Certainly just tonally. Complete 180.
Yeah, there is that jarring tone. So,
but in any case, other than that, So
you can do worse.
So, anything else you want to add? Nope. We're talking about spoilers. You don't want to talk about no.
No.
Okay.
We're done.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to Linoleum Knife.
Here's the second goodbye. Goodbye.